Okay, thank you. I don't have any controlling. There's no cockroaches in my presentation, but there is beer. So hopefully everyone has a beer. That will help. All right, yeah. I'm going to try to speed through this just so that we have some more time for questions. Cool. My name is Ryan Ingeman. I'm a certified Cicerone. That's like a sommelier for wine, but for beer instead. I work for Brewery Vivant. We're a small brewery. Oh, I heard a woo for that. Cool. We're a small brewery out of Grand Rapids. We're actually the first LEED certified brewery in the entire world. LEED is leader in energy and environmental design. Basically, it's just an environmental certification that you can get for a company. Cool. So we're going to start right into it. I'm going to kind of rush through the history section so we have some more time for the science and for the questions. But basically, about 10,000 years ago, humanity lived as a hunter-gatherer society. And that's what we did. We found fruits and berries, and we hunted for meat, and that's how we survived. Then sometime about 10,000 years ago, a switch happened, and it's called the Agricultural Revolution. We stopped being hunter-gatherers. We started farming. We started growing grains. We lived in one place. And because we lived in one place, we could form cities and societies and governments and mathematics and writing and music and Ann Arbor Nerdenites, all these cool things. And one of the cool things about this is a lot of scientists are actually saying this shift happened because we wanted to grow spelt, an early form of wheat, and we wanted to grow barley, and not just for bread, but for beer as well, which is actually really cool. You think about, we're here right now, we have society, we have culture, all these great things because of beer. Yeah, this is about 10,000 years ago, the switch happened. About the oldest actual evidence we have directly is only about 5,000 years old. We have some jars that were found in Mesopotamia with a substance called calcium oxalate on them. It's what we now call beer stone. It's the same stuff that builds up in beer lines at bars and restaurants, why you have to get your lines cleaned. The same stuff was found 5,000 years ago. So the beer was pretty similar to what we have today. It didn't have hops in it. There were some other changes. But it's pretty cool when you think about it. Moving along to Louis Pasteur. We're going to jump ahead to 1876. Louis Pasteur published his Études sur le Bier, the studies on fermentation, the diseases of beer, their causes, and the means of preventing them. So if we actually read through this, he says, I intend to establish that, just as there is an alcoholic fermentation, the yeast of beer, which is found everywhere that sugar is decomposed into alcohol and carbonic acid, so when we make beer, we take yeast and we make alcohol and carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide dissolved in a liquid is carbonic acid. That's what he's referring to. So also there's a particular ferment, a lactic yeast, always present when sugar becomes lactic acid. So at this point in time, yeast had been discovered. A lot of people miscredit Louis Pasteur with discovering yeast, but we'd seen them at this point. And so he was studying what makes beer go sour, what makes beer and wine go sour. And he discovered, in addition to these really big yeast cells that we'd seen, big relatively, we also have these tiny little microscopic cells called bacterium, like in our first presentation. Particularly, he was referring to lactobacillus, which he found. That's the one that makes milk go sour if you leave your milk out too long. It's the same beer that makes, it's the same bacteria that makes beer go sour. So by studying this and learning about this, he developed what we call germ theory, which is basically the idea that bacteria cause infections and infections are bad. So by studying beer, he developed this germ theory, which he then developed into pasteurization, which we use to keep our food fresh longer. He developed practices like basic sterilization practices and simple things like washing your hands. So it's crazy to think about, but before, you know, 1876 when this was written and Louis Pasteur championed this, doctors didn't wash their hands. They might do an autopsy, then do a surgery, then help a mother give birth. Really crazy to think about, but like, a simple act of washing your hands, which Louis Pasteur championed because he was studying infections in beer, came about, saved millions and millions of lives. The next one, we'll jump ahead to the same exact year. 1876 was the first commercial refrigerator was invented. So at this time, we had a lot of German immigrants in America. They were they didn't have their caves and cellars that they were brewing their cold lager beer like they did in Germany, and they wanted to make the same type of beer that they were used to. And so they were pouring lots and lots of money into refrigeration because it wasn't practical to do ice year-round to make beer year-round. And so a lot of the beer ads from the time, we have an ad from here from 1878, and still to this day, a lot of beer, you know, the coldest mountain beer and things like that. From there, we'll jump into the actual science of beer today, some modern brewing science. This is actually, I just snapped a quick picture of the lab at a Brewery Vivant. Got some Petri dishes, some hydrometers, hood vent, a few other bits and pieces here. It's like an autoclave would be over here, but I couldn't get in the picture. We use mostly iodide. There may be some star sand in the laboratory. I'm not sure. There's different ways of sterilizing. Star sand is a little bit more commonly used for home brewers. It's a little more expensive on a commercial scale. So yeah, this is the laboratory at Brewery Vivant. Most breweries these days actually have a laboratory. The only ones that really don't are like the smaller startup ones. And the reason is it's important to make consistent batch after batch. It involves a lot of science. People think of brewing as just an art form, but actually there really is a lot of science involved into it. And I think the easiest way to explain the science is to take it ingredient by ingredient. So we'll start off with malt. This picture is of the floor malting house at Thomas Fawcett in England. A lot of times if you see pictures of maltings, it's Thomas Fawcett, just because they're one of the few that still do it in this old traditional floor style, and it's much prettier to look at than what the modern ones do. But when I say malt, I'm talking about the seed of a cereal grain that's been started to germinate, essentially. So cereal grains are barley, wheat, rye, oats. They're any plants of the grass family, like that can grow in your yard, basically. Those seeds are what we use for most of the grains throughout the world. In brewing, we use primarily barley, but also a little bit of wheat, a lot of wheat beers. Some beers will have oatmeal stouts, and rye is found on occasion as well. So I mentioned malt is the seed. It's not called malt yet at this point. These grass seeds, basically they want to grow throughout the year, die off in the winter, and survive into the spring. So the seed on its own is very tough, very starchy, very steely, and not really good for anything. If it was a nice, juicy, sugary seed, like we eventually want to brew with, it would basically get eaten up and it couldn't grow again the next year. So what the maltster does is he takes the seed, he gets it wet, he warms it up, and he lets it start to grow a little bit, and he basically is fooling the seed into thinking it's springtime. So it's hard to see on here, but they'll actually moisten the floor. It's a lot warmer in here than it would be out in the cold ground in the winter. And so when the seed starts to say, oh, hey, it's springtime, I need to start growing, it'll take those long starch chains that aren't really high-energy starch chains, and it'll start to naturally produce enzymes which break that starch down into simple sugars. And those simple sugars are used in the brewing process. The yeast will be able to eat those simple sugars and turn them into carbon dioxide and alcohol and beer as we know it. From there, the maltster gets it to the point where it just starts to germinate a little bit and it produces those enzymes, and it maybe starts to break them down a little bit, but you want to halt that process before too long, because the seed will actually start to use all of those sugars to form energy, to grow roots, to grow leaves, before it can do it on its own. So what they do is they take it and they throw it in a kiln and they heat it up and they dry it out. And that's very important as well. They have to dry it to an exact moisture content, one, so it can be stored without getting mold or anything on it like that. But also, if the moisture content of that malt is off by, say, 1%, our final beer might be off by like 1% alcohol content, 1% ABV, which when you're trying to make consistent batch after batch, that's very problematic. So when we get malt, it actually has a tag on it that has an exact measurement for moisture content, alpha amylase percentage, beta amylase percentage. Those are the enzymes that break the starches down into sugars. It'll have an exact color on it as well. And that color comes from this kilning process. So for the base malt, they kiln it just a little bit to dry it out, keep all the enzymes in place. But we also have these all sorts of specialty malts where you keep roasting it, and we get what were called Maillard reactions. It's named after a Frenchman who discovered it. And if you think of it, it's like, I like to use the analogy of bread. You take a piece of bread, you eat it on its own, it tastes like bread, you know exactly what it tastes like. You put it in the toaster, you turn it up just a little bit, and you start to get some nice crunch to it, a little bit of a toasty note, some nice slightly nutty flavors. And then, okay, you put it back in again, you turn it up a little bit more, starts to get pretty brown, you know what that tastes like, you get a little bit more of some caramelization. With malt, depending on how you do it, you can actually get some almost like dark fruit notes. And then if you take that toast in there, you turn it all the way up, you forget about it for 5 minutes, and you come back when you smell the burning. Take it out of the toaster and take a bite of it. Well, it tastes like roast, burnt toast. We do that in malts as well. We try to get some of those burnt flavors. Sometimes we roast malts like a coffee bean is roasted, and it can get those coffee-like flavors. Sometimes you roast them like there's actually a type of malt called chocolate malt. It's roasted similar to how you would roast a cocoa nib. That gets some nice chocolatey flavors as well. And then the last point on malt we'll talk about as it relates to science is the mash and the temperature control on that. For the mash, you take the malt, we mill it and combine it with hot water because those enzymes, the alpha amylase and beta amylase enzymes, are activated at different temperatures. Beta amylase is primarily at about 147 degrees, and it breaks those long chain starch molecules off at the end into tiny little simple fermentable sugars, breaks them one at a time, and you get a lot of very simple fermentable sugars. So if you have your temperature at about 147, 145 degrees, you'll end up with a beer that is very, very fermentable. It'll be dry, there won't be a lot of sweetness in it, it won't have a ton of body. But if you increase that temperature and you use primarily alpha amylase as your brewing enzyme, that breaks that starch chain up randomly. And so you might get 3 glucose molecules over here and 5 glucose molecules over here all stuck together. And yeast can't eat a lot of those longer chain starches and longer chain sugars. They're called dextrins. And those add a little bit of sweetness to the beer, and they add some body to the beer because the yeast can't break them down into carbon dioxide and alcohol. From there, we move on to hops. It's a beautiful picture of a hop. Hops are the flowering cone of the humulus lupulus plant. They are one of the more popular ingredients we talk about a lot. I'm drinking a two-hearted here. It's very hoppy beer. Cheers, yeah. Drink a beer if you have them. All right. So why do we add hops to beer? Hops add flavor, both taste and aroma. They add bitterness, which balances out the sweetness of the malt. And they also have a bit of a preservative quality as well. So when we get hops in the brewery, just like how the malt has numbers on it, hops also on the package have an exact content for alpha acids, which are the bittering part of the hop. Alpha acids need to be boiled. They're not readily soluble in water. So by boiling them, we isomerize them, and it makes the beer bitter, which balances out some of the sweetness from the malts. We also get an exact oil content for different things like humulone, myrcene, terpenes, which are different flavor oils added to the beer from the hops. And I mentioned that the alpha acids need to dissolve in the boil to give the bittering portion. Well, those oils are what we call volatiles. So if you think of when you smell something, you're actually inhaling little particles of that. Well, when you boil your wort, your pre-fermented beer, all of those aroma particles just go up and evaporate in the air with all the steam. And so we add hops at different times. You hear about triple hopped beers. Well, every beer pretty much is triple hopped because you need to get one time for boiling or early in the boil to get bitterness, and then you add it later for flavor, for taste, and then you add it at the very end to get some hop aroma. Water. So water is probably the least talked about aspect of their brewing process. You know, people love to talk about different malts, and they really, really love to talk about different hops. But what makes up the vast majority of the beer actually is water. Anywhere from 95%, pretty typical, up to, you know, only 80% if it's a really, really high alcohol beer. But from a brewing perspective, water is incredibly important. Every brewery tests its water, every brewery that I know of, I should say, tests its water before they even start to brew. Typically, it's filtered, and then different brewing chemicals, different brewing salts, are added back into it. To kind of illustrate this point, we can talk about some brewing cities in England. So if you look at London, England, and then Burton-on-Trent, these two cities are less than 100 miles apart as the crow flies. They have basically the same malts, basically the same hops, but the aquifer in Burton-on-Trent flows through some gypsum, which is what we call calcium sulfate. And as the water flows through it, it picks up a little bit of that mineral content, and that water has a high content of calcium sulfate, as opposed to London, which flows through limestone, and that's calcium carbonate. And so the London water has a high calcium carbonate content. And so calcium carbonate is what we call an alkaline. Basically, that means it buffers a pH. So if you have something that's acidic, like roast malts are acidic, if you think of sometimes you drink some coffee and it's like, ooh, that's acidic. Well, the roasting process makes some acids. So that calcium carbonate is really, really great at buffering the low pH of highly roasted malts. And so the beer there was really, the water in the city of London is really, really great for making dark beers. And so London became famous for London Porter, London Stouts. If you go 100 miles away to Burton-on-Trent, that gypsum, that calcium sulfate, is really, really great at accenting hoppy notes. So the beers there are all basically pale ales, IPAs. Bass at one point was like the most popular beer in the world, right from Burton-on-Trent. Basically all because of the water content in these two different cities. Really the only difference makes two completely different beers. So then yeast is one of the least talked about behind water ingredients in beer, but one of the most incredibly important when it comes to the final flavor of the beer. Yeast is a single-celled microorganism. It is a fungus. It takes simple sugars and it breaks them down into alcohol, carbon dioxide, and other flavoring compounds. When we talk about different types of beer, they're typically broken down into two types, ales and lagers. So ales are made with Saccharomyces cerevisiae yeast. Saccharomyces literally translates as sugar fungus because it's a fungus that eats sugar. The other type is called Saccharomyces pastorianus. That's lager yeast. The pastorianus part comes from, it's kind of an homage to Louis Pasteur. Ale yeasts are typically fermented at a higher temperature. And that temperature difference allows them to create a lot of more flavor compounds than just carbon dioxide and water. So ales will create what we call esters and phenols. Some of the esters are ethyl acetate. It's found very commonly in English-style beers. Creates a really nice fruity note to it. Another one is isoamyl acetate. Creates a banana flavor. It's actually the same thing that put in like banana runts to give that artificial banana flavor. Some phenols like 4-vinyl guaiacol is a clove note. So if you've ever had a true German Hefeweizen, people talk about it tasting like banana and clove. Well, there's no banana added to it. There's no clove added to it. That's all from the yeast that's used. And then the other type of yeast is the lager yeast. Those are brewed at colder temperatures. And lager yeasts tend to produce, basically, the idea is to produce just carbon dioxide and alcohol and keep the fermentation as clean as possible. Then on top of that, we have wild yeasts, Brettanomyces, which 99.999% of your beer, you want to avoid wild yeast, unless you're intentionally doing it. Can be very bad in the brewing process because they create a lot of other different phenols that can do smoke. They can taste like what we say medicinal, what other people say is like old Band-Aid flavor, which, yeah. Do you want your beer tasting like old Band-Aids? I don't think so. The other one we talk about is barnyard or horse blanket, which basically that's why it's called that. It actually smells and tastes like that, which in some sour beers people love, and I personally love in sour beers, but you don't want that in your light lager or your pale ale or anything like that. That would definitely be an off flavor. Cool. All right. So I talked about every brewery pretty much has a laboratory. We can talk about some common brewing tests. First of all is temperature. Temperature I talked about a little bit in the mash being important, and then I talked about a little bit how ale yeast is fermented at higher temperature. Actually, temperature is the most important factor in the fermentation. If your fermentation gets too hot of a temperature, you'll start to produce off flavors. You can make that ethyl acetate, which in an English ale, in a light note, is a very nice fruity note. In high quantities, it tastes like nail polish remover. It's very solventy, not very pleasant to drink at all. But when you use like Brewery Vivant's all French and Belgian style beers, those yeasts are actually kind of intended to ferment at a higher temperature. And so we watch that temperature very closely. And by fermenting at different temperatures, we can bring out, oh, we want to bring out more esters. We want this to be more fruity beer. We want to bring out more phenols. We want it to have a little bit more of a spicy note, a little bit more of a clove pepper note on the finish. And then the mash as well, it's very important. We also test the pH. We actually have a pH meter. The acidity is very important during the mash. It's tested pre-fermentation. It's tested post-fermentation. It's a super easy way to tell if you have an infection. If your beer comes in and it's acidic, tastes sour, super easy way to tell for that. Then IBUs are another common brewing test. Most breweries don't have a facility for it. We actually have to send out for another one to test our IBUs. IBU stands for International Bittering Units. You can approximate it by measuring how much of that bittering, those alpha acids are in your hop, and then how long you boil it for. But that tends to be a rough approximation, whereas you can actually get that tested to get an exact number. Probably the most, what's that? Yeah, if you want to brag about it, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you see a lot of beers that say 110 IBUs, which you probably can't actually dissolve that much into your wort at that point. But by using that formula, it says it's 110 IBUs. I'm guessing a lot of those, if you got tested, might actually be down at like 80, 85. The most common test in brewing is what we call specific gravity. And we use a hydrometer. This here is a hydrometer. It's basically a piece of glass that's weighted exactly, so it floats higher or lower in more dense or less dense liquids. So when we start off with the sugar water called wort, before we ferment the beer, sugar is more dense than water. We turn that sugar water into alcohol. Alcohol is less dense than water. So by measuring that change in density, we can measure how much sugar has been converted into alcohol. And that tells us a lot of different things. It tells you, one, the ABV, how strong your beer is, but it also tells you how much residual sugar is left at the end of fermentation, how quickly your fermentation is going, whether it's your fermentation has stopped at all or not. And then that leads into, it tells us ABV. You can actually get that tested as well to be a little bit more accurate. And then last, if we go back to this lab here, you can see petri dishes. There are microscopes, they'd be over here. I didn't really get them in the picture. Most brewing labs have a microbiology lab of some shape or form. It's actually very important in the brewing process. We are dealing with yeast, a single-celled organism, and you need to make sure it's healthy and happy, and that you don't have any other unwanted things in there, like wild yeast or different bacteria. So one common test is to take your yeast, you dye it, you use a blue dye, and your living yeast will process that out, and it will no longer show up, but your dead yeast cells will stay blue. And so you count how many cells in a certain area are blue, and that tells you, well, this yeast cell is dead. Okay, 5% of our yeast cell is dead. This beer only has 95% vitality. And you measure if you can continue to ferment with this yeast or not, or if you have to start over. We test for vitality and viability is what that's called. And then also you can take cultures to test for infections. So if you're doing that test and you see little bacteria moving around, right away you can tell you have an infection. But a lot of times you can't quite see that. So it's easier just to do a culture. You take a petri dish and you look for things to grow. And specifically you're looking for wild yeasts. There's different mediums that wild yeast will grow really well in. Those Brettanomyces bruxellensis is one, which means like basically wild yeast of Brussels. Brettanomyces lambicus is another one. Lambics are another Belgian type of beer, a Belgian sour beer, which again, if you want your beer to be sour on purpose, I love sour beers, that's awesome. But if you don't want that, then it's very important you avoid that. Another thing we test for is lactobacillus, which is, again, that microorganism that makes your milk sour, also makes your beer sour. Acetobacter is another one. Acetobacter creates a substance called acetic acid, which is vinegar. A lot of what Louis Pasteur was studying was not just lactic acid, but hey, we've got this great beer, and by the time it actually gets to our customers, it tastes like malt vinegar. Well, if you have acetobacter, your beer is going to taste, it's going to turn into vinegar over time. And then the wild yeast gives it those funky notes. If you want a pale ale to smell like hops and it ends up smelling like horse blanket, obviously that's a problem. Okay, well, that's it for my presentation, but feel free to ask me questions throughout the night.